Hi, welcome everybody. This is a new sequence, a new edition of our Premises About Logic podcast. So where we try to discuss a bit of background, and we don't have any guests. It's just us two, Dennis and myself. And maybe Dennis can start asking the question.
Yeah, there's something I wanted to ask you about for quite a while now. And that's your take on dependent type theory. There's a lot of talk about it, but I'm not entirely sure about the details. So maybe let me start even more basic, even if that's a repetition, with type theory per se. So for me, types are like sets, but they aren't sets. There's this difference that you always make. And but
actually, to be honest,
yeah.
In type theory, the word set is such a nice short word, yeah, that we use it as well in type theory. So there is lots of situations where type theoreticians called type sets, and it started with Pierre Martin Loew himself. I mean, Pierre introduced type theory in two levels. He had a theory of types, which we will now would call a logical framework, and within it he defined what is a set. But sets were just types, so the word set is overloaded. And more modern, more recently, in homotopy type theory, the word set is used to describe a type which has a sort of simple equality, which we say a propositional equality. So the word set is not so clear to identify what is meant, but clearly, I mean, we can distinguish set theory and type theory. Right?
Maybe at that tangent for a second, I think this is the same phenomena as that the curly brackets in LaTeX are their own command, because I mean, set theory is so interwoven or with the language of mathematics and being a discipline at the same time. So these curly brackets are used in the syntax, so to speak, of LaTeX, and similar talking about sets, simply the general concept that's everywhere, and then they're set as a mathematical object with their own axioms. So it's always a little hard. Yeah.
There is much set theory influence on LaTeX, because I think they were just running out of brackets. I mean, you have round brackets, square brackets, and curly brackets in ASCII, yeah, and they use the round brackets and curly brackets for other purposes, square brackets, so they use the curly brackets. So I don't think there's any.
Yeah, could also.
I could be wrong, but as far as I know,
I don't think it's a deliberate philosophical decision. It's just that this symbol is used twice. This is what I wanted to say. It's once used as syntax and once used as the mathematical symbol curly bracket, and there you have these. You need these always to distinguish by this backslash. But staying with the type theory, so, and then for me the main difference is type theorists don't think about objects per se. They say there is an object and it has a type, and most of the time it has exactly one type, right?
It should have. I mean, in SEP theory, you already have all these sets, and then you form sets by basically using already existing objects and put them together in a set, and then do this again, and any object can be element in as many sets as you like, right? So sets are really defined by their enumeration, by their definition, by their intention. There is this axiom of extensionality, but it just means that a set is the order and some sort of multiplicity of elements doesn't really matter. But I would still call set theory very intentional, because really you really define a set by its elements. And I think that's in type theory that's different. a type. We introduce a type and the elements of a type at the same time. So when I define a type of natural numbers, then it introduces a zero element and successor. And you can be a bit confused because there is some notation, like to me, like zero and suck. But really, what is meant, there are just two ways to make a natural numbers, to make a natural number, either by zero or by successor. And there's no way to investigate this. There's no way to look into the actual definition. You only have an interface. What you can do with natural numbers, I mean, you can form them and you can do recursion over them, and that's all what we know about natural numbers. Right. So if I give you a different definition of natural numbers, so maybe one which is more space efficient, like binary numbers, right, would be a very good definition, and we can turn this into a precise inductive definition. So, it's a bit, we have to be a bit careful to avoid leading zeros, but we can do this. And then for you, there is no way from outside to distinguish the binary natural numbers and unary natural numbers, because all what you can do with one, you can do with the other. So in this sense, type theory, and here I'm talking about type theory, even with before homotopy type theory by its nature is more extensional, even intensional type theory, funnily enough, because you cannot talk about intensional aspects of your type. Yeah, you cannot talk about like how is this type constructed. You can only use the type in computer science lingo would be via the interface. Yeah. But I think that makes also lots of sense from a mathematical point of view. So natural numbers, they are not, it doesn't really matter how they are defined, whether we use zero and successor, or whether we use a binary encoding, or maybe yet another one. What matters is what you can do with them.
Mm, yeah, I see. And I mean, I think let's take this as our approximation to type theory for now. I think that's more or less sufficient for the audience. Now, before this whole program really went off, I think there is this key moment we already mentioned, Per-Martin Löw, of this step to dependent type theory. Mm-hmm. And what's the innovation there? What's new there? Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. Let me first, personally, I don't like the word dependent type theory, but that's a very personal thing. I talk about type theory, and one feature of type theory are dependent types. Okay, but it's true. This was an important idea due to Per-Martin Löw in the 1970s, and what was already around at the time were what we now call simple type theory. So, for example, System T, I think, which introduced by Gödel, which was a way to turn arithmetic, the piano arithmetic or writing arithmetic, into a sort of functional programming language, right? Where you have a type of natural numbers and you have functions, and then you can do things with it, and System T, the theory which exactly models what you can compute in arithmetic. So there's a, so in this sense, it's an implementation of arithmetic as a type theory. And the next was Jean-Yves Girard's System F, where he tried to do the same or something similar for higher order logic. So System F corresponds to higher order logic. So what's higher order logic? In normal predicate logic, you can quantify over individuals like natural numbers, but in higher order logic, you can only also quantify over propositions, right? And that makes it much more powerful. So Girard, this was like an open problem. Could one also have a syntactic definition of what is computable in higher order logic. And Girard provided an answer in the 70s to say, okay, here we use system F, here to use system F. There's also an interesting story about system U, which maybe could talk another time, which is inconsistent.
Paradoxes are always super important. And I mean, Girard's paradox. But right,
let me quickly describe this.
So, let's do that.
When you do system T, you can combine system T with arithmetic, and this is called HA omega or arithmetic in higher types. So you basically you have a predicate logic and you have computation, and that's fine. That's completely conservative. Nothing is happening. It's certainly consistent and it doesn't give you anything, no new computations. But then Girard had, when he captured higher order logic, he wanted to do the same thing. He said, okay, let's do this. Let's take higher order logic and let's take system F and let's combine this, right? So like playing the same game again. And he calls this system U. And I don't know, good to ask Girard. I think he was trying to prove the consistency of the system. And he didn't manage. And then being Girard, he went for the opposite and was able to derive a paradox, which was based on the so-called Bourali 40 paradox, that there isn't an ordinal of all ordinals. And he was able to encode this ordinal of all ordinals in system U, then concluding it's inconsistent. So that's also, okay, this is important for our next part of the story. Along came Pierre-Martin Loew, and he was interested in this sort of Curry Howard idea, so that there is a close connection between logic and these type theories, these simple type theories. So the observation is that that the provability corresponds to in simple type theory corresponds to constructing terms in simply type in lambda calculus. Right? But then the question is, okay, that's quite cool for propositional logic, but really we want to do predicate logic, right? So and to capture predicate logic, Pierre-Martin Loew then introduced dependent types. So what is a proposition? A proposition is just a type. But now what's a predicate? And a predicate is a dependent type. So the predicate of a natural number is basically a dependent type. Giving a natural number, it returns a type. Yeah. So it's a type depending on a natural number. And
is it okay to imagine this as like indices? I have like my being a multiple of, and then this by itself is nothing. It's but then I can plug in two, being a multiple of two, being
exactly
so even. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. So in modern type theory, this is also then again related to the notion of a function, but the function into a universe, but that's sort of more evolved. The basic idea is a dependent type, as you say, is a type which depends on a value, right? And these dependent types, they show up in logic, as you just say, for example, let's say prime. So prime is a predicate. That means if you plug in a number like six, then prime of six is the proposition, is a type, and an inhabitant of this type is a proof that six is a prime number, which obviously is not. There isn't such a proof, which means the prime that six is not a prime number. So this is an idea, and this is also important in computer science, because in computer science we also use dependent types. So for example, a sequence of a certain length, so a vector, a sequence of a length n, is a dependent type, because you can plug in 7 and you get a sequence of the length 7, which is quite useful in programming to be very specific about your data, right? So this is the I think one of the important ideas of Per Martin Löw, this idea of dependent types. He did much more, and in his first paper, he said, okay, he introduced a type theory, and he was quite brave, because he introduced a type theory which has a type of all types. So that was
sounds dangerous. You're playing with fire.
but maybe I don't know what he thought. I mean, he certainly knew Russell's paradox, but maybe he thought, because type theory is more disciplined, that he could get away from Russell paradox, right? So, because you cannot construct the set of all sets straight away, because you only have types. So I don't know what he thought, but he also said, look, this system is quite strong. I can also encode Girard's system F, and I can system T and system F can all be encoded in my type theory. And then Girard said, that's true, but actually you can also encode system U in your theory. And that's known to be inconsistent, right? So this showed that the first version of Per Martin Löw's type theory was actually inconsistent. He then, as always happens when these things, standard reaction is to become super cautious. So Per Martin Löw then rejected this whole idea of impredicativity. What does it mean? Impredicativity is basically the idea of higher order logic, that the proposition is just a type like any other type, or that you can quantify over types. And he abandoned this. So he introduced what is called a predicative type theory, where if you quantify over all types, you get something bigger. So this is unlike in system F. In system F, you can quantify over all propositions, which correspond to types, and you get a new type. So that is what we call impredicative. And Per Martin Löw, after he was bitten by the inconsistency, by the Russell paradox, or the Girard paradox in this case, he became very careful and introduced a predicative type theory, type theory, predicative theory, which he stuck with since. So I don't think he ever looked again or ever considered impredicative theories again, which were then introduced in the 1980s by Girard, Hewitt, and Thierry Coucon, who introduced the calculus of constructions, which is basically a combination of system F and Martin Löw type theory, and which was the first base for the implementation of systems like, which was called ROC now, and Koch earlier, and even other names earlier. But this was the calculus of constructions, which attempted or which attempts to combine system F and Martin Löw type theory.
Yeah, I think this is a nice story so far. And now I'm thinking, but why is this so powerful to allow one parameter in your type theory? And so this revolutionizes everything. Couldn't I encode that somehow, saying for every type I have infinitely other types, which are just the pair of the type and your parameter or something like that?
I mean,
it feels so minimal tweak, and it seems to have been such a revolution.
Yeah, there's a very nice talk by Conor McBride about the way he draws some comics, cartoon about a proletarian revolution in in type theory. So he says, okay, there is a colon. On the left of the colon are the workers, which he drew in red. Yeah, and they just have a shovel and they do all the work. And on the right is a aristocrat, a bourgeoisie. He has a blue. He has got a suit. He has got a cylinder hat. Yeah, and he smokes. He's never around when there's any work to be done, but he sort of controls everything. Yeah. And then dependent type theory opens the colon, separating them, and the workers walk over on the other side. And then the question is this like really bad as a revolution? Yeah, but actually it's a positive one because the types now become much more expressive. They can talk about much more things. They can distinguish. Can talk about terms. So in the formal theory, where previously the terms and the types were strictly separated, now the terms and the types are mixed, and this makes the types much more expressive.
I see. And can you help me with one? I mean, as a philosopher, I like this revolutions because it was driven by conceptual thought, right? It's not only a technical tweak for technical reasons. As far as I know, the story goes that that was based on philosophical reflections. Do you know the rough idea? What was the thinking to do that? What has this to do with types as judgments or something in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, as I say, the main sort of story is that Pierre-Martin Loew wanted to extend the Curry-Howard equivalence to predicate logic. Right? This is very formal. But actually, if you do mathematics, you very easily introduce something which corresponds to dependent types, right? If you say, like, I have a sequence of the length n, yeah? So like a sequence of real numbers, or like a vector of real numbers of length n, then you maybe have a process which for every natural number gives you a sequence of this length, right, of this length n. And that's basically a dependent type, right? So because you start to talk about a sequence of the length n, and now you have a function. So normally we think of functions as having an input and having an output, but here you have a function which has an input, but the output then varies with the input. You know, you say for every natural number n, I get a sequence of the length n. So what is this as a function, as an input, as a natural number, but the output is different depending on the input, right? So I would say, just from a very naive perspective, it's as soon as you do some constructions in mathematics, it's hard to avoid having some phenomenon like dependent types. And it turns out to be extremely powerful and extremely useful for also reflecting language, talking about language in language and so on.
Okay, I think that's a good primer to dependent type theory. Is there anything else we should talk about? Otherwise, I would call it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a quick word, what I said previously is I said, so type theory, okay, first of all, there are all sorts of variations and extensions of type theory. So, for example, there are intersection types and other variations of type theory. So these variations, they often have a subtype relation. So, and to me, this is not what I understand as type theory, because now types basically behave like sets. A certain term can have lots of types. And that's sort of useful in some applications. But personally, when I say type theory, I mean a type theory where terms have a specific type and not just not as lots of types. We sometimes introduce notational conventions to say, oh, if I write the number 3, then it could be a natural number, it could be an integer, it could be a rational number, it could be a real number. But I think this is mainly a notational convention that I write 3, and then, okay, depending on what you're looking for, I coerce it into these different types. But it doesn't really mean that from the foundational point of view that these types need to be formally related. So I would distinguish the sort of underlying theory and the presentation. And to me, this subtyping and so on, and I know lots of people do not agree with me, they are part of the presentation. Right?
Yeah. I mean, you can always have a canonical injection, right, to relate them even without having relationships of types, in your formalism.
I think it's important also for practical use for formalism to introduce this layer of representation, how you write things, right? But this should be also done in a formal way. But all I would say for me is a sort of foundational theory should be separated from the presentation. Otherwise, it creates lots of confusions and strange phenomena.
Which is maybe a circle back to the beginning where we talked about the mix of things as your construction of mathematics and as mathematical objects themselves.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's a good arc for this premises. So thank you for giving this primer. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure how many news we have, but I can probably already say that next week's episode will be a little historic. We will have a great logician and historian of logic around. And we started the membership program, which doesn't yet come with many perks, but with time, we are planning a few things like having proper lectures, maybe having monthly meetings or anything like that. So we will figure that out. Already, a huge thanks to those who support us before getting any perks. It feels like from the bottom of the heart. Thank you for the coffees. Thank you for commenting. We try to be very active there. Feel free to follow up if you don't think your question was addressed correctly. And thank you all for watching and for everything else. And then see you in a week when we talk about the history of logic. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.